Stand by for the fastest 60 minutes in Jewish radio. It's time for the Jewish Experience. And welcome back. Hey, is Israel heading for a sellout in Annapolis? Well, we have the inside track straight ahead. Hi, I'm Hirsch DeLynn, your host. You are tuned in to Pittsburgh's only Jewish radio program, The Jewish Experience. In a few minutes, we'll talk with Jonty Blackman, educator and lecturer direct from the State of Israel, who's in Pittsburgh at the invitation of the Agency for Jewish Learning. He's well-equipped to give us an update on just what will happen at the Annapolis Summit when Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, under four indictments and under investigation, meets with Mahmoud Abbas, the mastermind of the massacre of the Jewish athletes at Munich, the new peace partner. Stay close on this one, another JE exclusive interview. Well, getting back to the Parsha of Vayetze, as you remember from last week, Yaakov leaves Be'er Sheva, heads for Haran. He falls asleep on the way and puts his head down upon 12 stones, which become one under his head, and dreams about a ladder where he sees angels going up and coming down. Commentaries tell us that the angels that were with him in the Holy Land depart and are replaced by angels for Chutzlaretz, for outside the land. And Yaakov raises the stone he was sleeping on and says that this stone will become the house of God and was the place of the Holy Temple even today. In Haran, Yaakov starts working for his evil uncle Laban. Laban promises him his daughter Rachel if he works for 7 years. At the end of the time, Laban tricks Yaakov and gives him Leah, his older daughter. Yaakov agrees to work another 7 years for Rachel, and the evil Laban still tries to cheat him. Leah gives birth to six sons, while Rachel is none. Of course, echoing Sarah, Rachel gives her handmaid Bilhah, which has two sons. And, of course, Leah follows suit with Zilpah, her handmaid, with two sons. Finally, Rachel gives birth to Yosef. Now, Yaakov wants to leave, but Laban entices him to stay, and he does, another 6 years. But he has to end up sneaking out to get away. Laban ends up chasing after him, but God tells him not to harm Yaakov, so Yaakov makes peace with Laban. And he heads back to the Holy Land, where he's greeted again by the Holy Land angels on duty. And speaking of duty, our staff is on duty, ready to bring you the quality Jewish radio, of course, with Musical Moish, Rabbi Meir Goldwasser, Rabbi Yosef Eisen, and Ms. Deborah DeLynn, direct from the Land of Israel. So sit back and enjoy 60 minutes of the best Jewish radio in Pennsylvania. Of course, we'll have your community announcements and mazel tovs, along with current news fresh from Israel National Radio, coming up in the half hour. And if you haven't sponsored a segment yet, this is the time to do it. We want to continue to bring you the best and only authentic Jewish radio in Pittsburgh, but we're coming down to it. We must have your support. Please get on the horn, 412-979-5770, or call Jewish, write Jewish Experience at Verizon.net, and let us know how you can help. Consider sponsoring your favorite segment, of course, Rabbi Goldwasser's Torah Lesson, Popular Stories segment, Community News and Announcements, The Popular Feminine Perspective, and, of course, Rabbi Eisen's Moment in Jewish History is also available. You know, Hanukkah's around the corner. This is the time to get the message out, so call right now and reserve your spot. As always, we thank our regular sponsors, Burton Hirsch Funeral Home, Next Generation Financial Services, First Mariner Bank, Pittsburgh Simcha Orchestra, led by our own Musical Moishe, and Artistic Photography. Don't forget to ask for a special gift of a beautiful refrigerator magnet that is yours free when you call us at 412-979-5770 or send us an email at jewishexperience@verizon.net. And candlelighting time tonight is 4:44 p.m. Hopefully everyone's already home by now. It's getting real early.
לא שמעת אלוקי אלוקי עולם עולם השם לא ידעת אם לא שמעת אלוקי אלוקי עולם השם לא ידעת אם לא שמעת אלוקי אלוקי עולם עולם השם לא ידעת אם לא שמעת אלוקי אלוקי עולם השם.
An insight on this week's Parsha is our resident rabbi, Rabbi Meir Goldwasser.
The Gemara asks, what is greater, a Beis HaMedrash, a place where Torah is studied, or a Beis HaKnesses, a place where we daven? All of the blessings that we have from Hashem, we are able to elicit through our prayers, through davening. We find that Moshe Rabbeinu was not able to speak properly throughout his life. He stuttered. There is a very interesting Ramban. The Ramban says that the reason why he was not healed was because he never davened to be healed. obvious question is, why didn't Moshe Rabbeinu daven for this? The answer is, when Moshe Rabbeinu was young and was in Paro's court, he reached for the crown on Paro's head, and some of Paro's men took this as a sign that he would eventually uproot Paro. They therefore gave Moshe a test. They put a piece of gold in front of him and a burning hot coal. They wanted to see which one Moshe Rabbeinu would take. Moshe actually stretched forth his hand to take the gold. However, being that this would have been dangerous in light of his taking the crown, a malach, an angel, came and directed his hand towards the hot coal. Upon touching this hot coal, Moshe instinctively took it to his mouth and burnt his tongue. This was the source of Moshe's stuttering. Since Moshe recognized this as a miracle which saved his life, he never wanted to forget this great miracle. He always wanted to be thankful to Hashem, and therefore he never davened to Hashem that he should be healed. When we daven to Hashem, we have, so to speak, a one-on-one conversation with the Ribono Shel Olam, with the Creator of the entire universe. It is a very, very special time during the day. As David HaMelech said, Tehilo LeDavid, a praise of David, Arumimcho Elokai HaMelech, I will exalt you, my God the King. In other words, David felt himself praiseworthy. Why? Because he was able to speak to the Master of the Universe.
Retirement can be a wonderful reward for years of hard work, but it can also be stressful as you deal with questions about how to maintain your standard of living while protecting what you worked so hard for. What if I told you that you could generate extra cash flow without touching a penny of your savings, investments, or current income? If you or someone you love is 62 years or older and owns their own home, they may be able to take advantage of a federally regulated program called a home equity conversion mortgage or reverse mortgage. Seniors all across the U.S. are using reverse mortgages to increase their cash flow for purchasing long-term care insurance, putting grandkids through college, making charitable donations, paying off credit card debt, paying for prescription drugs, buying vacation homes, and paying for much-needed home repair. Call for a free copy of the Homekeeper Mortgage Consumer Fact Sheet today. Get the facts and help yourself and your family through a reverse mortgage. Call Andy at 412-562-2220 for a free copy while supplies last. Again, that number is 412-562-2220 for your free copy of the Homekeeper Mortgage Consumer Fact Sheet. First Mariner Bank is an equal housing lender.
Will Israel ever see an end to violence? How will the war against Iraq's insurgents impact Israel? Will changes on the Supreme Court have any effect on the Jewish community? Is anti-Semitism in Europe on the rise? What can be done about it? For a look behind the headlines, read the Forward, the nation's Jewish newspaper. The Forward reveals the personalities, motivations, and histories that are fueling the news abroad. The Forward also provides an in-depth look at issues affecting us at home, with comprehensive reports on everything from politics and religion to culture and the arts. It even has its own matchmaking section for Jewish singles. Try 4 weeks free, then be billed $24.95 for another 26 issues. Not satisfied? Just write cancel on the bill and keep the first four issues free.
Call now for the Forward, 800-992-3333. That's 800-992-3333. All around us, life is moving faster and faster. Things are changing all the time. And it's a comfort to know in your time of need that at Burton Hirsch Funeral Home, the Jewish tradition continues.
Burton Hirsch Funeral Home has served the Pittsburgh Jewish community since 1947 and has recently remodeled its entire facility to better serve you. Burton Hirsch Funeral Directors are members of the Jewish Funeral Directors Association and work closely with area rabbis to ensure that your needs as a Jewish family are totally met. Their attentive and compassionate guidance results in treating each family as their own. I personally met with Michael Hilgefort. And did you know that Burton Hirsch Funeral Home is even involved with community educational programs to ensure that Jewish families know what to do to have a proper burial? In your time of special need, call Squirrel Hill's only Jewish funeral home, Burton Hirsch, at 412-521-2600. That's 412-521-2600. They welcome your request to visit and tour their state-of-the-art facilities. Burton Hirsch Funeral Home, proud sponsors of the Jewish Experience, 412-521-2600. Now it's time for A Moment in Jewish History with the author of Miraculous Journey, Rabbi Yosef Eisen.
An episode took place in Lavan's house that bears an uncanny resemblance to the Jewish experience throughout the ages. The verses are in Bereishis chapters 30 to 31. Verse 30, "You, Lavan, had very little before I came, but since then it has increased and become very substantial." Parallel in Jewish history. Jews build up country. Verse 43, "The man Yaakov became tremendously wealthy. Jews prosper in exile." Chapter 31, verse 1. "And he heard that Lavan's sons were saying, 'Yaakov has taken everything belonging to our father and has become rich by taking our father's property.'" Jews are accused of exploiting the country despite earning their wealth honestly. Verse 7. "Your father swindled me and changed his mind about my pay at least 10 times, but God would not let him harm me." Jews prosper despite all restrictions and discriminatory laws. Verses 36 through 42. "Yaakov argued with Lavan, 'What is my crime? What did you find from your house? Never once did I take a ram from your flocks as food.'" Jews try to prove their innocence to their anti-Semitic accusers. Verse 43, Lavan replied, "The daughters are my daughters, the flocks are my flocks, all that you see is mine. Jewish entreaties fall on deaf ears." All that happened to Yaakov happened to Yosef. A quote from Rashi in Chumash Bereishis chapter 37, verse 2. The events of Yosef's life likewise reverberate throughout Jewish history. Rabbinic tradition teaches that as a punishment for the 10 brothers' sale of Yosef, 10 great sages, including Rabbi Akiva, were brutally executed by the Romans. The wife of Potiphar falsely imprisoned Yosef in Egypt on trumped-up charges of immorality. Likewise, Christians in the Middle Ages killed their own children and accused innocent Jews of ritual murder. And in the United Nations, Israel stands accused of the most heinous crimes by nations such as Syria and Iran, who have massacred countless numbers of their own citizens. In addition, Yosef's rise to power in Egypt is the first of many cases of Jews succeeding in a foreign country. Yosef died in Egypt in 2309 at the age of 110, having served as the divine conduit for bringing Yaakov's family to Egypt to escape hunger in the land of Israel. This is Rabbi Yosef Eisen wishing you a very happy Shabbos.
Now, from the Israel National Radio Newsroom, here's Ernie Singer.
The Jerusalem Post says that the defense establishment is recommending that the government refrain from making goodwill gestures to PLO President Mahmoud Abbas until after the Middle East summit in the United States, whether it's on November 27th or later. A Kuwaiti newspaper says the U.S. is considering postponing the meeting because a number of Arab heads of state are considering sending lower-level officials. Prime Minister Ehud Olmert bringing the release of 400 terrorist prisoners before the cabinet on Sunday. The PLO has demanded the release of 2,000. Other gestures being considered include removing roadblocks and transferring additional territory in Judea and Samaria to PLO security control, as well as restrictions on Jewish housing in the area. A senior security official telling the Post, there is no need to make concessions ahead of the summit. The Palestinians will quickly forget what we gave them before the summit, and it is important to create incentives for Abbas to make the summit work. According to a senior official, the defense establishment is examining the ramifications of a proposal being drafted to release several hundred prisoners a month after the conference, as well as a request by the PLO to transfer armored jeeps to its security forces in Judea and Samaria. While the military intelligence and planning divisions opposed the idea, the Office of the Coordinator of Government Activities in Judea and Samaria and the Shin Bet General Security Service favor the transfer. According to the Post, Shabak officials have also warned that Abbas might be tempted to blow up the summit under the pretext that Israel was not making enough concessions, a senior defense official telling the newspaper that the scenario was just speculation, not based on concrete intelligence. Hamas has released most of the 400 Fatah leaders arrested at this past week's rally in Gaza, in which Hamas killed 8 people and wounded 100 others. Deposed PLO Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh says that those who were involved in riots and disturbances are still in custody. According to the Bethlehem-based Ma'an news agency, Arab journalists in Gaza have condemned ongoing violence against all area members of the media. The journalist said that Hamas militias attacked the staff of a German television station and arrested a local photographer. Journalists also accusing Hamas of using grenades and live fire against reporters. Quoting a statement by the group, "This dangerous escalation against media came in accordance with the decision to ban public freedom by force taken by the dark forces which staged a coup in Gaza." German Finance Minister Peer Steinbrück will meet with representatives of Holocaust survivor organizations in Israel on Wednesday to discuss his country's reparations agreement with the Jewish state. German officials say Steinbrück will meet with the survivors themselves rather than with Israeli government officials in order to get a sense of the day-to-day experiences of those who lived through the Nazi terror, according to Army Radio. Ron Erez of the Secondary School Teachers Association waiting outside the Prime Minister's office Friday while the Prime Minister met with Education Minister Yuli Tamir and Finance Minister Roni Bar-On regarding the association's strike of high-end middle schools. The Prime Minister writing an open letter to the teachers in the Yediot Ahronot daily asking them to go back to work. Speculation saying that a Saturday night rally by the striking teachers could be a celebration if the walkout is settled by then. Senior academic staff announcing that they will strike all university programs not funded by the state beginning on Sunday. Foreign and military students exempt from the latest measures. The lecturers say they are taking harsher measures because the finance ministry has stopped negotiations. The News First Class website reports that the Haredi religious community in Israel will need approximately 260,000 additional apartments between now and 2025, according to recent research conducted by Na'ot Hapiska Modi'in Limited. The community is expected to buy 160,000 second-hand apartments and 99,000 new apartments. The need for apartments is expected to increase dramatically over the next decade due to the large family size in the community, where couples have an average of 7.7 children. The difference between supply and demand could cause housing costs to rise sharply over the next several years. With less than 20 shopping days left until Hanukkah, the Feast of Lights is inspiring serious and not-so-serious campaigns. Find out more with Yishai Fleischer and Gil Ronen on demand on the Internet at IsraelNationalRadio.com. Shabbat is Zion, the 7th of Kislev on the Jewish calendar, and the weather forecast clear to partly cloudy, becoming warmer and drier than usual through Sunday. Monday afternoon, scattered showers and isolated thunderstorms. The rain getting stronger at night, possibly lasting until Thursday, with a significant drop in temperatures. In Jerusalem Friday, 23 degrees centigrade, 73 Fahrenheit. Ernie Singer, Israel National Radio.
That was a look at Jerusalem weather. And now, for your local weather, here's meteorologist Glenn Foxen.
A chilly Shabbos is in store for us Pittsburghers, with a few rain and snow showers predicted. Nothing significant as far as accumulation goes. Just a few flurries or snow showers that could whiten the ground in some grassy areas and on the top of cars. A high-pressure system over Canada will move cool air on northwesterly winds into southwest Pennsylvania. Some moisture will be picked up from evaporation over the lakes, and our forecast area will see considerable cloudiness on Shabbos and into Sunday, with the chance of some scattered rain and snow showers. And as I said, just a dusting of snow at best, and most likely it will happen during Saturday night. The forecast for Pittsburgh and vicinity. For Shabbos day, mostly cloudy, breezy and cool, with the chance of some light rain and or snow showers. High temperatures around 40 degrees. Saturday night, mostly cloudy, with the chance of some light snow showers, a possible dusting of snow. Low temperatures between 25 and 30. On Sunday, partly cloudy and cool, the high temperatures rising into the low 40s. Wishing everyone good weather and a great Shabbos. This is meteorologist Glenn Foxen.
We want to wish our brothers and sisters in the Holy Land a very peaceful and restful Shabbat.
And we have a big Mazel Tov this week. Peretz and Rivka Abramovitz on the birth of a daughter. And Rabbi and Mrs. Ellie Rothman on the marriage of their son, Chesky. And this just in, Mr. and Mrs. Betzalel Melamed on the engagement of their daughter, Meta. Mazel Tov, Mazel Tov. And his new class on Israel, Spirit of the Land, Why We All Care, in five locations, Squirrel Hill, Shadyside, Downtown, South Hills, and Fox Chapel. Visit myjli.com for more information, or you can call 412-421-3561. And the Father and Son program at the Kollel is continuing. 7:15 to 8 p.m. right after Shabbos ends, at least three prizes. Pizza and cookies, all kinds of neat stuff. Bring someone new and receive an extra prize raffle ticket. Call the Kollel for more information, 412-420-0220. The Meeting of Food Addicts and Recovery Anonymous, meeting at Shari Torah every Sunday evening, 7 to 8:30 p.m. Program is a recovery group for people who cannot control their eating and or their weight. Program is not for women only. Men are invited. For more information, call Ilana at 412-422-2224. Don't forget, if you'd like to have your Mazel Tovs on our program, let the Jewish community know what you're doing. Please call 412-979-5770, or you can email jewishexperience@verizon.net by noon on Wednesday for that week's program. Don't forget, candlelighting time this week is 4:44 p.m. We'd like to welcome this afternoon Jonty Blackman, who is a scholar in residence for the Agency for Jewish Learning, who is normally living in Israel, but is with us in Pittsburgh for a short period of time, speaking and lecturing quite a number of different groups. Jonty, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And I know you've been on the go consistently, and I appreciate you taking your time to be with us. We'd like to have you speak to us today on the summit that's in Annapolis that's coming up, and causing a lot of controversy in Israel. Finally, it looks like groups are waking up, paying attention to what's happening. There is the Likud, Benjamin Netanyahu, who has formed the new Jewish coalition, and then there's Manigat Yehudit, which is the runner-up, so to speak, Moshe Feiglin in the Likud last election, forming the new Jewish Congress to oppose the Annapolis summit. We got Ehud Olmert, who is under indictment from four different areas in his country and under investigation, and he's negotiating with Mahmoud Abbas, who is the of the Munich massacre athletes fame. So looks like it's a lot of crazy players, and it looks like a lot of solid opposition. So going into the Annapolis summit, what are the expectations? What are the guidelines? Where are we going?
Okay, I think that the expectations of the Annapolis summit are not very big.
Good.
I think that is one of the reasons also why it took people so long to wake up to actually respond to the summit. I believe that most Israelis didn't really think that this would actually go about, that the conference in Annapolis, that the summit would actually happen.
Mm-hmm.
I think what took place was that it seemed almost a surprise that this summit is actually happening, and perhaps the reason why it's happening is it's certainly being pushed by the USA and being taken by Ehud Olmert as perhaps an opportunity for him to take himself to a different place and perhaps to take Israel for a different place.
Sure.
So I think that's the basic feeling within Israel. I think, though, that as the summit is coming closer and it seems that it will be happening, so people have come together to try and oppose what is happening for two reasons. The one being because I think there are people on the right who believe that this is dreadful for Israel, and especially if the summit fails. Number one, what will be the outcome, and will there be another round of violence, God forbid, like there was after the Camp David Accords?
Sure.
And number two, perhaps it's also a personal issue where people are trying to vie for their position and therefore are using the summit as a positioning tool, as to a certain degree Ehud Olmert is using it as a positioning tool to see if he can perhaps change the way that Israelis look at him.
Sure, but how can he even have the moral ability to go into this thing, seeing that he is under investigation from so many different areas? His personal polling and popularity is, I think, close to single digits here. So how does he go forward in that way? Doesn't the Knesset have something to say about what he's doing?
I think the Knesset has a lot to say, but they're choosing not to say it. And I think the reason they're choosing not to say it is because, unfortunately, there are no leaders at the moment that people are choosing and believe that would make a difference to him. I think if you look at Ehud Olmert, especially after the Lebanon War, and because of these corruption charges that are against him, he should have fallen long ago.
Sure.
Most Israeli governments have fallen on far less than what Ehud Olmert is having to face. And even though he's having to face that and he's the prime minister who's the least popular in all of Israeli history, he's still in power. And the truth is he's not having to fight every day for his own power. And I believe it's because Israelis are just tired of what's been over the last few years. And if there was someone else who perhaps they would believe in and have faith in, perhaps they would go against him. But because there isn't, they're letting him go. And I imagine that what will happen is until there comes a time where it seems that he's really going to endanger Israel, people will let it happen. And so I think that's what's going on.
So his plan, I mean, is talking about no Jews in 80% of the old city, destruction of yeshivas, no access to the Mount of Olives. These are just some things, Jews thrown out of their homes. Worst of all, no entry to Jews ever again to the Harabayit. This is crazy stuff. I mean,
I think what you're saying is crazy stuff, but I don't think what you're saying is really what Ehud Olmert is talking about. I think these are the opposition leaders that are putting words into his mouth.
Okay.
And I think, therefore, it is taking what could be, to a certain degree, the discussion of a division of Jerusalem and taking it to the worst scenario that could be and saying that that's what he's talking about.
Okay, so if he's not talking about that, what is he talking about? And what is the basic precepts that are going to be discussed in Annapolis?
The truth is not very much. The basic precept is to come to Annapolis in order to discuss and see that there's someone with whom to discuss. For so many years now, we've said that there's no partner for peace, and the Israeli government has said that Mahmoud Abbas is not a partner for peace. Even until basically a few weeks ago, he was not a partner for peace. And suddenly with this concept of Annapolis, he has become a person who people are saying, or at least the government is saying, that he is a partner for peace. So they're going to discuss whether they can discuss real issues. And the three real issues that will be discussed afterwards, if Annapolis does come to some kind of success in their eyes, is the three major issues that are always the problem issues, and that is, number one, Jerusalem, and therefore people are touting the concept of the division of Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, the final borders that will be between two states, a Palestinian state and between an Israeli state. And number three, the concept of the return of refugees, which the Palestinians call the law of return for Palestinian refugees from 1948 and from 1967 to return to their borders, not only to where a new Palestinian state would be, but to what would be the Israeli state, and going back home to places like Jaffa, Haifa, and even the villages on the road towards Jerusalem.
Yeah, but it seems to me, and not just me, but much that I've read and seen and talked to and all kinds of groups, that all these things are non-starters. I mean, there's just almost no way, especially the concept of the law of return. If they did that, I mean, they would have to do something about eligibility for voting, because it would cease to be the Jewish state in a very short order. How are they going to deal with that?
I don't think they're going to, and I think that's sort of why they, throughout the process of the last decade and the Oslo Accords, we've always got stuck on the real issues. We've discussed many other issues, but these are the real issues that that haven't been able to do. So for the statement that you said,
mm-hmm.
that certainly the right of refugees to return to the borders, not of a new Palestinian state, but what will be the Israeli state, will not be acceptable to Israelis in any way. And so what has to happen is some kind of change that will come in, not from the Israelis saying that there will be a right of return, but from the Palestinians of saying they have to give up on some of their maximum statements that they want, of the idea that all of this has to happen. But I think what Israel is saying is, or wanting, let's say what the government is wanting, is that if we have some kind of trust, then at least we can come to some kind of negotiation. I think also perhaps what we need to understand is this, that quoting from a professor at Hebrew U, Jonathan Mervis, who describes the situation in the Middle East as a Turkish bazaar, that you got to know when you go into negotiations, you have to realize that there's some kind of bargaining. And so if you put down your bottom line, you're not going to be able to start the negotiations. So everyone's starting with much higher expectations than what they want. And the question is, what's going to get whittled down as they discuss and have the negotiations?
Sure, but it seems like Abbas has actually been emboldened by this, and the negotiations, at least from his spokesman, have really turned even more tougher. It seems like as they get closer to it and as they go into it. And here we have, speaking of trust, that brings me to the next segment of this, and that is Mahmoud Abbas, the guy who is past, people seem to want to forget, number one. But number two, even talking now, he has no real control over his whole people as it is.
Absolutely.
So who we discuss, who are we negotiating with? So, and Hamas is right behind him to just totally blow the whole thing up. I mean, it seems like a colossal waste of time. So I don't, you know, I have no idea what the point is here in anything. And I don't even know why the U.S. is doing this. So you had a comment on that in another forum, why the U.S. is doing this. Why don't you comment on that?
Okay, I think that what's going on here is not really an issue about the Palestinian-Israeli situation. It is taking the situation that we know so well and saying that one of the issues of the Middle East is really about a far bigger issue. However, what is that bigger issue? That bigger issue is the issue of Iran. Iran is such a problem today of where it's going to be and what it's going to do, not only to the Middle East, but the effect that it will have on the world, that everyone is nervous of Iran. However, to have to attack Iran or have to discuss the issue of Iran openly now, the U.S. is on its own, perhaps together with Israel, and that's it. And so the question is this, which I think is what the U.S. is really trying to ask. If we can get all the Arab states, or at least most of the Arab states in the Middle East, to come to a discussion about an issue that they can agree upon, and what they can agree upon is the idea of a Palestinian state, then there will be some kind of trust-building measures between the U.S., Israel, and the Arab states. Once those trust-building measures are in there, then at another stage, we can then talk about the issue of how to, together, the U.S., Israel, and these Arab states go against Iran and bring down some threat that the Iranians are posing to the area and to world peace. And that is also one of the reasons why you'll hear in the news so much discussion about bringing Syria into the whole summit, because Syria is an ally of Iran, and to a certain degree, as opposed to the other Arab states, has got closer to Iran over the last few years. So the idea is to bring in Syria in the sense of trying to see, can we break this alliance between Iran, Syria, and then the other two terrorist organizations being Hamas and being Hezbollah? Can we, if we have all these states talking about an issue that is a problem for them, or at least talking about an issue that is something they agree upon, eventually will allow them to talk about an issue that really is a problem for them, because they too need to be afraid of the power of Iran to cause havoc in their own home countries as well.
So you would say that the pan-Arab areas are actually behind this summit as well, because they would rather, are you saying, they would rather be with the U.S. on trying to solve this situation than letting Iran kind of dominate the region?
If they come to the summit and support the summit, then I would say the answer is yes. One thing for sure, it is the U.S.'s interest to try and get them behind it. So I think that the people who are really pushing the summit is the USA, and then Israel going in together with the USA, saying that perhaps this is tremendous strategic importance to the entire region.
Okay, so on the back of all this is Knesset member of Knesset, Benny Alon, who had come up with a plan seeming that Mahmoud Abbas really does not have the ability to control his own people, and the Palestinian Authority is really a sham, has proposed that the Palestinian Authority be dissolved, and Jordan, which has expressed interest in coming back in, so to speak, and taking back over what they had lost. What's the realistic future in that kind of plan? Is that something that Jordan would prefer? Is it just something that people are talking about? Has Jordan said anything publicly? Where are we going with that part of it?
I believe that we're not going anywhere with that plan. I think that it's Benny Alon's idea. Perhaps there may be, at some stage, there was some merit in it, but certainly I don't believe it's realistic at the moment. Jordan's definitely not relating to it in any way, and most of Israel is not relating it to any way, because one of the key factors of Benny Alon's plan is that Jordan should be the Palestinian state, and Israel, the entire section of Israel to the west of the Jordan, should be the state of the Jews and the state of Israel. Yeah. And no one takes that seriously anymore, and the discussion is about a two-state solution on the western side of the Jordan River, which would be a Palestinian state in parts of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and an Israeli state in the area that is Israel and perhaps part of what was taken from 1967. So I think it's Benny Alon's plan itself. One of the other key factors of that is that he says that if the people, the Palestinians living in what would then be an Israel, state of Israel, they would not have Israeli citizenship, but rather have Jordanian citizenship.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And if they would not, they would not commit to the law and to commit to the support of the state, then they would be voluntarily transferred to Jordan. I don't believe anyone's going to voluntarily be transferred and allow themselves to be transferred. So I think to a certain degree his plan is unrealistic, and I think most Israelis are not really taking it seriously. And therefore, to a certain degree, Ben Elon has come up against a brick wall of not getting the support that he wanted to for his plan.
Okay. On the other hand, again, if there's no real Palestinian authority, I guess in name only, I don't know how they're ever going to go anywhere. So it looks like we're spinning in the same things we've always spun, and things going back and forth, but no real anything anywhere. And it's kind of sad in a sense, because you hope that something would get resolved, but it looks like it's not. So.
Absolutely. It's sad. It's a difficult situation, especially for those of us who live there, that this is how it has to continue to be. And perhaps not because this has to continue to be because this is our choice, but rather because on the Palestinian side, they are not prepared to recognize the state of Israel and allow Israel to live in safety, and at the same time demanding demands that are absolutely impossible and perhaps unfair as well.
Sure.
I think from the Israeli side, Israel may not have always done the right things towards the Palestinians, but I believe that if you listen to what Israel has said over the last while, Israel has come a far lot closer to understanding that the Palestinians have some claim, and if the claim is only because they believe that they have a nation, then at least to try and say, we are prepared to give you something. That was part of what the disengagement from Gaza was. And Israelis would, if they knew that this would bring some form, if it's not full peace, but some form of quiet, they definitely would give parts of the West Bank to the Palestinians.
Sure.
But at the moment, I don't believe that's a realistic option.
Yeah, I think they've worn them down to such an extent. But we are out of time, so I do appreciate you being with us and taking your time. I know you're exhausted, and it's been a whirlwind thing, but you've been great, and it's been fascinating discussing this with you. I hope we'll have you back on next time you're back in Pittsburgh. Jonty Blackman, scholar in residence for the Agency for Jewish Learning, and also lives in Israel, and also is an educator and lecturer over there as well. Jonty, thank you very much. Have a good Shabbos.
Thank you.
Take care. now for a look at the feminine side of things. Reporting from Israel, here's Ms. Devorah Delin.
One of the most interesting things I've had to live with in my dorm is learning about and getting along with girls from different nationalities. French, Spanish, Dutch, Italian, Austrian, Americans, South Americans. Each nationality has its own culture and mentality, and sometimes their customs are quite different from the ones we're used to. For example, it's a common French custom to greet another person with a kiss on each cheek. For me, this was no surprise, as half my relatives are French. But for other Americans, a kiss is a little much when a handshake will do just fine. However, the hardest thing to deal with is the languages. Yes, Hebrew is our base language, but when a group of girls from the same nationality are together, they'll use their native tongue. This caused some friction between the girls simply because one couldn't understand the other and would assume the other was saying something not nice about her. As we've explained before, one of the strongest powers of the Jewish people is through our koach lepeh, the strength we have to draw down godliness through our words. Yes, words can do immense good. One has to use them carefully because they can also do immeasurable damage. In this week's Torah portion, Parshas Vayetze, we learn about Yaakov Avinu's marriage to Rachel and Leah, the daughters of Laban HaArami. Leah, as the girl that was used by her father to trick Yaakov, was blessed with many children to make her feel important in the eyes of her husband. Rachel, the girl of choice, was barren. As is normal in these cases, Rachel was jealous of Leah. The verse says, Havali banim ve'im ayin mesa anochi. Rachel says to Yaakov, her husband, bring me children, and if not, I will die. Yaakov angrily replies, who do you think I am, God? Typical family squabbles? The Ramban comes in to clarify an occurrence we don't see very often between our lofty patriarchs. Rachel Imenu came to Yaakov to ask him to bring her children, which most understand to mean that Yaakov should pray for her. But Yaakov gets angry at her request. Ramban says it's because Yaakov was already davening for her, but she would still bug him and wasn't satisfied with his prayers. He tolerated this, but when she came and said that she would die without children, he became angry because she was using her koach lepeh incorrectly. He thought that she was doing what a lot of spoiled women do. When they don't get something, they say they'll just die if they don't get it. Just take a look through our classical literature. Yaakov angrily replies that Hashem is the one in charge of giving children, and that she, Rachel, should be davening for herself as well. Other rabbis say that Yaakov was angry at her jealousy. He thought it was a simple, petty jealousy that one gets when someone has something that they want. The Kassav Sofer brings an interesting opinion forth and says, yes, Rachel was jealous, but it wasn't petty jealousy. Rachel knew the commandment in the Torah that says a man can't marry two sisters, yet Yaakov did it because the Torah wasn't given yet and he was already betrothed to Rachel. Breaking the betrothal was against the current law of the land. Therefore, he married her, but Rachel thought perhaps he didn't want children with her because he didn't want to make his, quote, sin any worse. Finally, the Or HaChaim says that Yaakov was angry because of what she said, that she gave herself a curse of death, and we know that the words of the righteous are the words Hashem listens to. In truth, everything we say has an effect, whether it be in a dormitory in Kfar Chabad or a mystical effect in heaven. God hears everything we say. Let's make sure it's something worth listening to. Have a good Shabbos.
Now it's time for another classic story from our master storyteller, Rabbi Meir Goldwasser.
It was Pesach Eve, and all the Jews had gathered in the shul for davening. Lights twinkled in every Jewish window, and a yontif feeling permeated every corner. The service was just about to begin, when there arose a disturbance with the entrance of two men into the Beis HaMedrash, arguing very loudly. They were Aaron Shmuel and Betzalel Chaim, who carried on a brewery in partnership, selling their beer in the surrounding villages. It appeared that they had just met coming into shul and had discovered that each one had expected the other to sell their chametz, and now they learned that it had been left unsold. Since chametz which was left unsold over Pesach could not be made use of, It meant their ruination. But what could they now do about it? They were so grieved at such a grave oversight that in their distress they blamed each other over bitterly, shouting and quarreling. But Tzalo Chaim claimed that as he had the job of traveling around, it was obviously his partner's place to attend to the matter of selling the chametz. But the latter found an excuse, which nevertheless did not alter the fact that their chametz had not been sold. They were troubled indeed. They turned to the Rav to advise them how they stood regarding the beer in the brewery. The Rav called the Dayun, the head of the Beis Din, and together they decided as follows. The beer, which was contained in the barrels at their brewery outside the town, should be poured out, and nobody should have any benefit therefrom. And all the vessels and barley used for the beer making should be locked away until after Yontif. But Tzalo Chaim was not satisfied to leave the decision as it was, but begged the Dayon and Rav with tears in his eyes to find him some penance, a way of doing teshuvah. His partner, too, was deeply moved and also stepped forward to learn how they could make amends for the sin of being in possession in chametz on Pesach. Seeing the distress of these two simple but pious men, the Dayan strove to assure them that their guilt was not as grave as they thought, nor the penalty as severe as they believed they merited. We see from here the great piety of these two people. They had just lost their fortune. They had to throw out all the beer that they had, and yet their main concern that bothered them was the fact that a few moments during Pesach they owned chametz, even though that it was strictly an oversight. The Seder night was no pleasure for them, but Tzalo Chaim made a solemn vow that not only would he not benefit from the beer which was already made at the brewery, but that he would accept no profit from whatever the brewery contained. He meant to show Hashem how truly sorry he was at what had happened. Only after he had made this vow did he feel easier and continued the Seder with a lighter heart. When he had retired for the night and was just about to fall asleep, he suddenly was startled into wakefulness by a red glow shining through his window. He realized at once that the fire had broken out somewhere and quickly put on his clothes. By the time he came outside, the sky glowed even redder, and people were running about shouting, "Fire!" without as yet knowing where the fire was. As the people ran in the direction of the fire, they soon realized it was just on the outskirts of the town, in fact, just about where the brewery was. And sure enough, when Tzalo Chaim reached the spot, he found the brewery and the two nearby houses in flames. All that they could do now was to see that the fire did not spread any further and reach the other houses. When the people saw Tzalo Chaim and realized that everything he possessed had been destroyed in the flames and that he was now a poor man, they looked upon him with sympathy in their eyes. But to everyone's astonishment, they found him beaming and just dancing for joy. Here you have an example of a simple Jewish man. He had just lost everything he owned, but he had been bothered so deeply over the fact that he, by mistake, had chametz on Pesach, that he was relieved that through this he would obtain an atonement. This story was told to us by the Friedrich Rebbe, and certainly every detail is exactly as it happened. This is Rabbi Meir Goldwasser wishing you all a good Shabbos.
As we wrap up another Anti-Annapolis Summit, Israel sellout edition of the Jewish Experience radio program, a couple of reminders. Speaking of Israel, why do we all care? Spirit of the Land is a class from the JLI, which is available. Call 412-421-3561 for more information on that. And Father and Son program at the Kollel, the learning occurs after Shabbos is over. You want to call 412-420-0220, all kinds of prizes and cookies and pizza and all kinds of neat stuff. Meeting of Food Addicts and Recovery Anonymous, Shari Torah, Sunday evening, 7 to 8:30 p.m. Call Ilana, 412-422-2224. And don't forget to call us if you want to have your muscle stuffs on our program, 412-979-5770. Or you can email Jewish Experience at Verizon.net by noon on Monday for that week's program. We want to thank Johnny Blackman, of course, for his encouraging update on the Annapolis Summit and the fact that hopefully nothing will come out of it. And, of course, our faithful and cutting-edge staff, Rabbi Meir Goldwasser, Rabbi Asaph Eisen, MusicalMoist.com, Dr. Michael Shulman, Mr. Vora DeLynn, reporting, of course, from Israel. And our engineer, where else would you get this kind of stuff? And our engineer, the ever-present, ever-popular Jeremy Bossenstein, for another outstanding show. Don't forget, candlelighting time is 4:44 p.m. It's been a ton of fun. I do have to run, especially now. It's getting real tight. Jump in that car. I'm Hirsch DeLynn. See you all next week. Same Yiddish time, same Yiddish channel. Don't forget, we're available on the web at JewishExperienceRadio.com. So if you want to hear us on again or hear us later or tell your friends, JewishExperienceRadio.com. See you next week. Shalom. Shabbat.